Near the end of the Civil War, a baby was born to a young slave woman in Diamond Grove, Missouri. Soon afterward, night riders came and stole both mother and child away and carried them to Arkansas. The owner of the slave girl hired a man called John Bentley to go down and retrieve his lost property. And some days later, Bentley returned with only the little baby, now nearly dead. When asked where he had found the child, he said somebody they had given him to some women folk down in Conway. But he said he ain't worth nothing. A little black infant survived, and his name was George Washington Carver. And he was worth a lot. But if that little black baby had lived to complete obscurity, or never survived at all, Bentley's estimate of his worth would have been far short of the mark. All human beings are remarkable and precious because God has plans for them. Carl Schurz, a young contemporary of Abraham Lincoln, who once observed that ideals are like stars. You won't touch them with your hands, but like the seafaring man on the desert of waters, you will choose them as your guide and follow them, and following them, you will reach your destiny. Schurz made his own mark in the world and is remembered perhaps more for the fact that he said those words than he is that he was a cabinet officer in government and that he was a senator from Missouri. Ideals are like stars. And there is an ideal human being. There's an ideal man, an ideal woman. Young people say heroes. They have their heroes, their ideals. The definition of ideals, I suspect, is simply to say that they're the stuff of the heart, dreams of life's perfections, things that ought to be. Ideas that give direction to life, visions of the spirit that focus thought, guide choices, and beget character. It's important for you to have ideals. And I am convinced that we live in a generation that has very few. We are pragmatists, all realists to the core. Feeling as though there's nothing out there in the future for us, we are grubbing about to get everything we can in the present. And some of the ideals that we cherish in this society are not happy ones. Preposterous illusions of overweening pride, the brilliant scientific Superman, or the Omega Man, marvelously fashioned by accidental co-location of atoms through the power of evolution. Others are nightmares of stoic resignation, trying to translate meaningless struggle into nobility. I always remember the poem of William Henley from my high school days called Invictus. I thought it was wonderful then. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. It was the cry of a person who said, I am blooded by chance and circumstance, but I am not bowed. Life meant nothing. I found no purpose, but I determined not to yield to anything. Plato believed that behind the world of sense was a truly real world of perfect and eternal ideas. These were the ideas by which the prime mover, the word he used for the creator, ordered the universe. And he was reaching in these conceptions, however lamely, for the truth. Because all ideals at last come out of the mind of God. Man is a product of a divine idea. And there is divine energy working to accomplish this. And we must choose for ourselves whether we're going to be a part of that or not, and we are accountable for that choice. The true ideal for humankind, both man and woman, belongs, like all ideal conceptions, to the Creator. So what that says to us is that it's only in knowing the mind of God that we can know ourselves, what we're intended to be. And some of us don't have much conception of that. Malcolm Muggeridge expressed it a long time ago when he said that His earliest memory was of being 6 years old and walking down the road in somebody else's hat and wondering who he was. He said, "We're all displaced persons. We're refugees here. We don't fit." There's something missing inside of every man and every woman, and what's missing is that ultimate ideal, that dream that God has had about us and which He's put into us. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 3, He has put eternity in our hearts. It's our burden. It's the anguish we have in being human. We are not content to be animals. We are not content to know nothing. We are not content to be nothing. We are not content to have no direction. We are not content to have no purpose. And that is because God has planned and dreamed something for our lives. We may be refugees now, but it's not God's intention that we remain that way. We're going to be speaking tonight from two great chapters of the Old Testament, the 31st chapter of Job and the 31st chapter of Proverbs, with the intention of searching out from these chapters a picture that the wisdom literature gives of the ideal man and the ideal woman. Perhaps you've noticed this already, but the wisdom literature does not deal with man as a Jew. It is addressed to people under the law of Moses. It is addressed to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but it does not wrestle with the question of how to be a Jew or how to live profitably as a member of the nation that God set apart for His purposes. The man in the wisdom literature is the man of Genesis, the son of Adam. What I want you to grasp with me tonight is the fact that man is at the heart of God's eternal purpose, at the center of all reality, and there's nothing inconsequential about it. Why did God make the world? He made the world so we could live here. That's the only reason for it. I know that you're not as big as the nearest sack of sand, but the whole of the universe is not important as you are. And that's the reason David cried out in Psalms 8, verse 3, "When I behold the heavens, the moon, the stars, the work of your fingers, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you visit him? You made him a little lower than the angels," and some have translated a little lower than God. And then David speaks about the dominion that he gave to man. What you've got to understand is that from the very beginning of Genesis, man is a noble being, a royal being. He is given charge and control of the whole of created life in the world. And he's intended, says God, to rule over that. There was a time then before the worlds were that you and I lay but a silent thought in the mind of God. Ephesians 1:4 says, "Even as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world." That's almost beyond our powers to conceive. And that we are at the center of the eternal purpose. God wanted a people. And the third chapter of Ephesians, verses 10 and 11, speaks about that and says that through the church he has made known his manifold wisdom according to his eternal purpose, which he purposed in Christ Jesus. His people were the object of his concern before he created the world. Having a people is the purpose of everything created. Everything that exists, the last star that you can see in the furthest reaches of the world, is here simply to provide a habitation for man. So God dreamed and schemed, and he intended, as he says in Hebrews 2:10, to bring many sons to glory. And that each one of those sons should be transformed, Romans 8:29 says, into the image of his son. I'm still trying to take that in. The idea that God intends that I should be like his only begotten. That it's his intention to work out his purpose to its final conclusion. And when everything is done and when his craft is completed, then I will be like, you will be like, if you're willing to be, like the Son who is eternally his. Men were not incidentally created then, not out of some idle curiosity of God. We were specially crafted in the image of God, as Genesis says, so that we could become what he planned for us to be. So keep in mind as we start this study tonight that God has something surpassingly wonderful in mind for you, something transcendently special, and you ought to have that as your ideal. G.K. Chesterton said the reason that people develop new ideals is because they don't want to keep the old ones. And he observes that the old ones are better, and that's right. The ones that have been in place for a long time. I might suggest to you before history, the ones that have been in place in the mind of God. That's the oldest and the greatest of all ideas, and the only true ones. God's eternal purpose, His great ideal, has been ruling providence ever since the beginning. In Genesis, when He created man, everything that happened thereafter was in order to accomplish His purpose in bringing man to glory. And so we are expecting to see, as we read the wisdom literature of science, and indications that that image, that ideal is present. And I think it absolutely is. Psalms reveal a sovereign God that rules over all the nations of men, and He's called there the King of the universe. He is the King that rules over all the nations. Psalm 22 and verse 28. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before Thee, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and He's the ruler over the nations. You must never forget the fact that God rules over everything here. That He's not a God pitched over in some corner, for He has some narrow, limited influence and deals with religious matters. Religious matters are at the heart of human existence. They're at the heart of the existence of all reality. And we don't wrestle with religious questions. You don't wrestle with reality. We are all created to see God, says Paul in the 17th chapter of Acts. He said that God made the world and everything in it, determined the appointed seasons of man, the bounds of habitation, that we should seek God. That's your purpose. That's my purpose. We're not put here to follow some occupation. We're not put here to invent some wonderful new contraptions that men can glory over. We're put here to seek God, and failing that, we're going to miss the ideal and lose it. You and I may be foolishly content with lesser visions of ourselves, but God is not going to be, and some of us show very great evidence that we're not unhappy about being mere animals. And we behave ourselves accordingly. We may reject the dream that God has for us, but we cannot escape the consequences of that rejection. The story of man is the story of marvelous beings called into an inexpressibly high calling and living like brute beasts. We talk about wasting the environment. You talk about pollution. There hasn't been a greater waste in human history nor a greater pollution of God's great realities than the waste we put ourselves to in view of what God has done to make great things possible. That's a waste. I want to ask you tonight, what are you doing with your life? What are people going to remember later? What's going to last when you're gone?
You say, let the old people think about that. I tell you, it's too late for the old people to think about it.
This is a question that young people need desperately to consider, because their lives are being lived. And if they live without direction, without purpose, then they're living their lives in total waste. God's ideal man and woman are found in the counsels of the Old Testament sages. And it's a very important study that we get into tonight, because we're living in a society that has turned passionately self-absorbed and self-centered. I have never seen the like of people focusing on themselves as I see in this generation. Everybody concerned that they get what they want, that they find some sort of fulfillment for themselves. The unique identities of men and women have been thoroughly blurred by humanistic philosophy and by feminist rhetoric, I might add. This is not a society fascinated by ideals. We seem to love to live in the garbage. We stick our eyes and our ears and our minds into consummate filth. We are content to live in an open sewer of immorality, ungodliness, and corruption. And each of us lives just to see something for the moment, because we don't have any concern for the future. That needs to change. And it certainly ought not to be true of Christians. People in our generation don't have any patience with calls to discipline, to self-sacrifice, in order to achieve some future ideal. Don't talk about pie in the sky by and by to this generation. They don't want to hear about it. And I might add, in these times of economic crisis, we don't want to hear about the long haul. We don't want to hear our politicians get up and say, well, it's going to be a long time and it's going to take some rigorous self-discipline. It's absolutely possible for us to escape from this difficulty, but we're going to have to put our shoulders to the wheel. We don't want to hear that. We want to hear what they're going to do about our plight here and now, right at this very moment, to get rid of this unease that we're feeling. We're not so much interested in becoming something as in getting something. Honor, duty, devotion are words without meaning. Feel-good messages without demands are in the spirit of the age, and that characterizes a lot of the preaching that goes on. You read the sermon titles in the Saturday paper and see if that's not validated. In the face of such social forces as these, we need ever more desperately to know who we are in God's scheme of things. Otherwise, we're going to be swept into the abyss of these contemporary absurdities and lose both ourselves and God. Now, I want to warn you that that's the case, and you can do it sitting in this meeting house. By what you do outside of it. What you feed on. Open the 31st chapter of Job. The reason we select Job, because this is a study of the wisdom literature. And God himself describes this particular biblical character in Job 1 verse 8 as a perfect and upright man. And Ezekiel takes his name and that of Noah and that of Daniel as exemplary characters in Ezekiel 14, verse 14, and says, as he warns the people of Jerusalem before impending disaster, he says, if these three men were in Jerusalem in the face of what's going to happen to you, they could only save themselves, couldn't save anybody else. So he was a righteous man, an exemplary man, a man whose life was held in high esteem by the ancient Jews. Who is Job?
Usually we don't think about that. He was
not a Jew. Probably a Semite. Likely lived in the patriarchal period before Moses ever went up Mount Sinai. In the time of Abraham and before. Though it could have been later, because he could have lived after the time of Mount Sinai as a Gentile at the time when the Jews were separated by their own covenant. But Job's story is the story of mankind in general, pain and perplexity, suffering and blessing, but mostly suffering. He's not remembered like Abraham is for going up on the mountains of Moriah and offering his son as a sacrifice in absolute submission to God, a declaration of amazing faith. He's not remembered as Moses is for going up the summit of Mount Sinai and receiving the tables of the law from God. Job's life was just a patient, dogged endurance of his faith in the face of long adversity, just like you and I often do. Our lives sometimes don't seem very spectacular. Ordinary, mundane, we slog through life trying to make it what God wants it to be made. And I want to tell you something, that's heroic. Some of us don't think so. We're always looking at heroes who did something wonderful. And there's nothing more wonderful than a life that is lived tenaciously, methodically, dedicatedly, day by day, and even minute by minute, in the service of God, no matter what the circumstance. Chapter 31 is Job's final defense of his integrity against his so-called friends. 29, 30, and 31 are sort of a section that goes together. Chapter 29, Job recalls the great days. He says, in the great old days, everybody got up when he walked into the room. Princes would stop speaking to listen to his wisdom. The old men would defer to him. In those days, he was a source of blessing to people who were distressed. He says in verse 15, I was eyes to the blind and feet was eyes to the lame and I was a father to the needy. But in chapter 30, he bewails his present wretchedness. He says it's not that way anymore. Now the lowest of mankind spit on me. People that perhaps I would have had nothing to do with before now treat me with utter contempt. And then finally, he defends himself. I want to tell you about Job. He was a wonderful man. because of his unyielding faith.
He'd come up against several things at the beginning. The Sabaeans, he is told by the messenger that comes, stole the oxes and the asses and killed his servants. And while that man is talking, another messenger comes to tell him that lightning's just killed the sheep and all the shepherds. And then finally, the terrible tragedy, the storm has just killed all his children.
And Job said in Job 1:21, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord."
In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. And then Satan brought a terrible, wretched illness on Job, so that his health is gone. He's racked with it. It's not just something that happens every now and then. It's not a long headache. It's a terrible, tragic, loathsome disease that gives him no peace and no rest. And yet, in spite of that, in Job 2:10, "What shall we receive good from the Lord, the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil?" he asked. In all this did Job not sin with his lips.
But I tell you where Satan got to. He used his friends to attack his relationship with God. I won't tell you, that's the point where we must defend ourselves. Anytime Satan attacks our relationship with God and makes us doubt, he has got us
in the palm of his hand. What Job did as a result of this long illness.
I tell you, I can be a hero in a short illness. Most of us can. But when the illness goes on, the suffering goes on, the heartache goes on, that's another story. And finally, the friends of Job come to comfort, and Job bought their philosophy that God does not allow a righteous man to suffer. And Job knew he was a righteous man. And so he came to believe, before this book is complete, that God was wrong. Let's look at the defense that he makes. It's not my purpose tonight to study Job and his general struggle with disaster and pain and anguish, but to get out of this 31st chapter a sense of what an ideal man would be like. I tell you one thing it's going to do for you is help you appreciate that these fellows that lived back in the patriarchal period were not just some spiritual back numbers living in a primitive kind of moral and spiritual world. We have that impression, you know. People that were rather rude and crude in their approach to God. First thing that he says in this chapter is, "I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then should I look upon a virgin? For what is the portion from God above and the heritage from the Almighty on high? Is it not calamity to the unrighteous and disaster to the workers of iniquity? Does not he see my ways and number all my steps?" How could I do that?
He's saying, make the charge against me. I have kept my heart. I made a covenant with my eyes. I want to tell you the reason that a lot of people are sinners and do bad things. Not because they started out one morning and said, "I'm going to be wicked." But because they never made up their mind and never purposed in their heart to do good. That's the failing of most of us. We never said, "I'm going to be good." What about you? Have you ever said that? What did it mean? What did it mean when you said, "I want to be good," if you said it? Did you understand by that this great ideal of God? Did you understand God's idea about what a man should be? Or are you living your life just like the old hobo who was asked the question how he decided which way to go in the morning? He said, "I just got up, put his back to the wind, and went where he was shot." You know, this is not a way to live your life. The way you're going to be shoved in the direction, is it the direction of selfishness and evil? Job said, "I made up my mind that that's the way it's going to be." Daniel said, "I purposed in my heart not to defile myself with the king's dainties." And Ezra said, "I prepared my heart to know the law of the Lord and to do the law of the Lord and to teach in Israel statutes and ordinances." And Joseph, before the blandishments and allurements of the wife of Potiphar, said what was so obviously the outspoken cry of a purposed heart. He said, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" I want to tell you something. Job understood that God doesn't want you thinking lascivious thoughts. He understood that. And he didn't do that. Why, that's the Ten Commandments before Mount Sinai. "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, or anything that is thy neighbor." That's the Sermon on the Mount before the Sermon on the Mount. "Whosoever looks upon a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery already with her."
with her in his heart. Job understood that. You need to stand in some awe and regard for the fact that all through the ages, God's had the same dream for everybody. He didn't have an ideal that he was willing to throw away just because you and I don't want to achieve it. That's his ideal. He's had it from the beginning. It's his dream. He will not give it up. The question is, will we take it up? God's not going to give up his dream. You want to live ideally. You want to live like you ought to live. You ought to live purely with regard to the opposite sex. That was his attitude. It's not only that, but Job also had the attitude about his neighbor's wife. In verse 9, if my heart hath been enticed to a woman, and I have laid wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind to another, and let others bow down upon her. For that were a heinous crime. Yea, it were an iniquity to be punished by the judges. And he said earlier on in verse 3 that this lascivious look, that this lascivious thought is a calamity. And the second part of the verse, a disaster. Is it any marvel to you why we live with lasciviousness in this society, why we are wholly inured to fornication? It's nothing to us. As I noted with you recently in a lesson from the book, The Closing of the American Mind by Bloom, in his discussion with a college girl. And he asked why nobody was concerned about what was going on in the dormitories. Wholesale fornication. And one of his students said, it's no big deal. Well, I'm going to tell you something. With Job, it was a big deal. And I want to tell you something, too. With an ideal man, the man of God, it's a big deal. And we cannot live in that sort of filth. And what amazes me is the number of Christians who sort of titillate themselves with this disaster. And let their minds wander in desire to those that they have no business longing after. This was a married man. And he knew what that covenant meant. What it meant was, you not only do not find yourself with your neighbor's wife, God forbid that you should violate that covenant too, but you don't look out on those unmarried to avert. You don't look out on those. Your love has chosen and you are committed to it. Somebody said, but Job's wife was a shrew. That's our excuse. My wife doesn't understand me. I'm not getting what I deserve. My life is not happy. That's not the issue. The issue with Job was that he had made a covenant. He had promised. And he was going to keep. We don't have ideals like that. We only have ideals for the fair weather. We only have ideals when things are going wonderfully well. We only have ideals for those times when everything fits together, but we have no ideals that are going to endure the storm. I want to tell you something. God's man has ideals that endure the storm when things are not just exactly what you thought they were going to be. That's a heroic man. But there's more in this chapter. There's also Job's honesty and truthfulness. Verse 5, if I have walked with falsehood and my foot hath hasted to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance, that God may know mine integrity. If my step hath turned out of the way and my heart walked after mine eyes, and if any spot hath cleaved to my hands, then let me sow and let another eat. Yea, let the produce of my field be rooted out. He's just simply saying there, if I have coveted other things than my own, if I have been dishonest, if I have been deceitful, if I have dealt with guile. He was absolutely honest and truthful. And he says, I'm holding that up as a defense. I've lived my life with honesty. Job knew that God's man could not be filled with hypocrisy, deceit, guile. God hates a lying tongue, as Proverbs makes evident, Proverbs 6:16. Flattery and double dealing, which sometimes we are guilty of. We pat everybody on the back. Say one thing to the face and another thing to the back. Faithful to the wounds of a friend, says Proverbs 27:6, but the kisses of an enemy are profuse or deceitful. Better we inflict the wounds that a friend should inflict, because we're always the same. Because we don't play a game. Because we have a real concern about other people. And we're not going to be deceitful. The only kind of man that God could have that met his ideal would be somebody who didn't lie, because God can't lie. Titus 1, verse 2. And he's the God of truth. How many times has that statement been made in Scripture? Job was not only absolutely honest and truthful, but he was just and fair in his treatment of others. Verse 13 of the 31st chapter. If I have despised the cause of my manservant or of my maidservant when they contended with me, what then shall I do when God rises up and when he visits? What shall I answer him? Did not he that made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb? He's saying there that we're all brothers in creation. He may be my manservant. He may be my lesser in terms of the economic situation. But he is equal to me in creation and equal in the mind of God. How can I misuse him? How can I treat him unjustly? Job asks. You want to be an ideal man? Then you always deal with others fairly and honestly. No deceit. In the 38th to the 40th verse of this same chapter, Job discusses corrupt business practices. It's stated in an agricultural sense. If my land cries out against me and the furrows thereof weep together, if I have eaten the fruits thereof without money, or have caused the owners thereof to lose their life, if I have cheated somebody. You know what cheating somebody means? Cheating somebody in a transaction. Getting too much money in change and keeping it. Knowing that the person has sold something to you ill-advisedly. Put the wrong price on it. Didn't know what they were doing. I'm talking about somebody who intended to put another price on. And we know that that's happened. We mix things up in the bin. Bring it up and sell your soul for that. You can't be that kind of man and be the ideal man of God. But it's more than that. 16th to the 23rd verses of this chapter tell us that Job was compassionate. He was not just just and righteous and fair. Always truthful. Always the same. He never had to worry about his word. Never had to be concerned about his promises. Because they'd be fulfilled. But he was a compassionate man. And so he says, if I have withheld the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, or the fatherless have not eaten thereof. Nay, from my youth he grew up with me as with a father, and her have I guided from my mother's womb. If I had seen any perish for want of clothing, or that the needy had no covering, then let me be judged. Job understood that he had to have compassion on those who were unfortunate. I mean, a concern for the poor runs throughout all the wisdom literature. God intends that his people be concerned about poor people. I want to tell you something. We have no much of poverty in this land, but we may know more. And people are going to need the help of those who have something. What are we going to do? Keep it for ourselves? It's a question that troubles me. Troubles me personally. The ideal man is a man who will give his property to others who need it. Who will share with people having a difficult time. It don't have to be some paragon either. We say, I'm waiting for a good man to come along. Then I'm going to help him. I tell you what, he's not going to appear. Because we've just upped the scale so that there won't be anybody out there that'll be worthy of our largesse. Anybody poor, anybody needy, anybody struggling, anybody suffering should be the object of the concern of God's ideal man. But Job is more than that. Job is compassionate not just to his unfortunate neighbors and friends, but he is compassionate to his enemies. That stuck out when I read this first. Just a little insert. Verse 29. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him that hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him, yea, I have not suffered my mouth to sin by asking his life, or by asking his life with a curse. I have not rejoiced at the destruction of my enemy. This is an anticipation of the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount, that we need to love our enemies. Job understood that. You want to be an ideal character? It will not be some Arnold Schwarzenegger type that comes in with his AK-47 blazing, blowing all the bad people away. That's not the weaponry of the ideal man, the strong man, the truly strong man. The weaponry of the truly strong man is to be able to be compassionate to those who were not compassionate to you, to show love to those who do not show you love. I tell you, Job did probably the most outstanding job of that
imaginable in his treatment of his wife.
He was crushed. He was desperately ill. And his wife comes to him and says, why do you keep up this facade, this myth that things are going to work out? Why do you keep on hoping that everything is going to turn out for the good? Why not end the misery? Curse God and die. It seems to me that Job remembered that she had lost her children too. And that people that are in that kind of misery sometimes say things that they wouldn't say at another time. In fact, he said that to his friends in Job 6:26 when they were attacking his every word, watching him carefully to be sure that they picked up on any kind of flaw. He says, do you seek to reprove words, seeing that the speeches of one that is desperate are as wind? I know I'm saying a lot of crazy things. But he said, I'm a desperate man. He recognized in his own wife that kind of desperation, that kind of anguish. And he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women. Now that may sound pretty hard. But it seems to me that he's saying, you're not yourself today. He didn't say, you're one of the foolish women. He said, you're talking like them. But that's not how you are. That's not what you really are. That's not what you have the capacity for. You're not yourself. There's something finer in you than that. And he does not believe that she's one of the foolish women. I think I made this observation once before here that we've all been harder on Job's wife than her long-suffering husband was. I've said a few things that weren't too complimentary. Job became the father of every bit as many children as he'd had before in the future. But there's no mention about another wife. That may boggle your mind. It is obviously a statement from silence, a speculation perhaps. But who can say but what his patient, selfless love restored her? And wonders happened in those times. Maybe she had just as many children again. But what I want to tell you is that God's ideal man is a patient, long-suffering, compassionate individual who loves even those who do not love him. Job was the spiritual leader of his family. You remember about Job that he offered sacrifices for his children in case they had sinned. He was concerned that all his family should follow the Lord, and he was concerned that they should be passionate in their service of the Almighty. I would think that we have already seen from all this that the foundation of the life of Job was in the fact that, as he says in verses 24 and following, that he never let anything come between him and God. Not gold, not the wonders of the world, which are the product of his genius. Always it was God. He never worshipped idols. He never loved things. He never put his heart into things that were transitory and inconsequential. Always, he says, he loved God. And had he done that, he would have denied the God that was the foundation of his life. I want to say this to you, and it seems to me it's obvious, that we don't need any special revelation to teach us that our work in this life is to serve God with all that's in us, to know our Creator, to know His will, and to let that will work in us. It's the undergirding quality of the whole of Job's life. He reverenced the Lord above all else. His life was not about wealth, and it wasn't about the beauty of the universe. His life was not about things. His life was about God. Unfortunately, many of us are drunk with the worship of things, of nature, or of ourselves. And we repeat the muddle-headed blunders of people that have gone by. It doesn't speak well of us. Our task is to serve God. One of the grandest statements of the wisdom literature is contained in another place in Proverbs, but in Proverbs 9:10. You ought to write this on your heart. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The wisdom of the wisdom literature is not philosophical. It's practical. And it's obvious. And it's realistic. And the most realistic thing that's ever said here is, look, the first thing you need to do is reverence God. Now, everything else is going to flow out of that. But the first thing you need to do, and the first thing I need to do, is reverence God. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Therefore, Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust the Lord in all your ways, and lean not upon your own understanding.
In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths.
That is wisdom. Young people, are you wise? Who guides you in your decisions? What image, what heroic image of what you want to be and need to be guides you as you make your decisions day to day? In your relationship with other young people? In your relationship with the world? In your relationship in the kingdom of God? What guides you in making your decisions? Do you have that image of this heroic person? Of God's dream for you before your mind is seen in this ancient worthy man? Do these great truths mean something to you? And inseparably linked with the idea of the worshipful heart is the idea of the lowly mind. Proverbs 15, verse 33, the fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor goes humility. And in the Old Testament wisdom literature, in the Old Testament its entirety, the humble heart is the heart that's broken and contrite in spirit. With him God dwells. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Now, in the last few minutes, I'm going to talk about the 31st chapter of Proverbs and the ideal woman. This is the second of two addendums to the Proverbs of Solomon, of the ones that he wrote himself or that he collected. And these are the words of King Lemuel. We don't know who King Lemuel is, and they're the words that his mother taught him. And he's not ashamed to say that his mother taught him these things. Taught him not in the sense of some hierarchical position over him, but taught him as mothers guide their sons, and as wives help their husbands. And he says, she taught me some things that are important. And I suspect when he gets down to verse 10, this is the description his mother gave him of the kind of wife he ought to seek. Well, everything we've said so far applies to God's ideal woman because we share the image of God. We're all made in the image of God, male and female, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. We're joint heirs of the grace of life, of God's eternal purpose, 1 Peter 3, verse 7. Joint heirs. Called to the same glorious destiny in Romans 8, 28 and 29. All of us going to be conformed to the image of his son. There's no question of sex that's involved in that great scheme of God. No question of gender. And contemporary efforts that have been made, and there have been plenty of them, to turn men and women into rivals, set them at odds with each other, or ungodly and devilish and unholy. But I think we see it. That was one thing that came out of this study today. America told the truth that there is great tension between men and women in this country, and no wonder. With the kind of philosophy that's been taught, that's going to happen. That's not love. It's everybody scrambling up the ladder to success and each one kicking the other off in order to get ahead. That's not the kind of relationship that builds happy homes and happy marriage relationships. It turns into war, and that's exactly what has been created. But if we are the same in the image of God, if we are the same in our destiny, we are not the same in our roles here. Biology testifies that it's not the same, and the Bible says the same. We have to face that reality. Woman is the grand climax of God's creative genius. He comes to the crescendo of all the symphony, and he takes a rib from the man's side and makes her, and to him she was everything, save God. A wonder of wonders, the one that was meant for him. But I want you to look at this woman who described here. She's married too. Our ideal man is married, our ideal woman is married in these two chapters, but I want to tell you that does not mean that ideal women and ideal men are always married. Ideal men and ideal women come in all shapes and sizes and colors. They don't have the same personality. Some of them are quiet and some of them are very boisterous. There is nothing alike in all those qualities, but at the heart of their personality, they are the same. We're going to read about a woman here who's very industrious in the commercial world, but that does not mean every ideal woman is busy in the commercial world. But what you get if you read this story, this worthy woman who can find for a price is far above rubies, that just simply means she's a precious commodity. Solomon couldn't find one, he says in Ecclesiastes, 7th chapter. Precious. And perhaps in many ways more precious than the man. I have heard it said that in comparison to the case of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, that the woman is like that in life. She has to do everything that the man does, except she does it backward. In the case of the woman, she does all this work, but she's doing it in submission. She's doing it as a follower. She's blessing as one who yields. That's harder work in many ways than the one who leads, though I tell you, the leadership is responsibility that's heavy. But this woman is a woman who clearly, industrious as she is, and she's industrious just to read about what she's doing here and make you tired. The heart of her husband trusts in her. That's the foundation of the relationship. Why do you suppose this woman was such a woman that her husband had no doubt about it? Because she was a woman that feared God. That's the foundation of every relationship. It's the foundation of the ideal woman. She fears God. If you're a woman tonight who does not fear God, and I'm not talking about somebody who shakes and quakes when the thought of divine judgment comes. I'm talking about somebody who reverences God and who's shown her love for him. If you're a woman who does not fear God, then you're not a fit companion for any man. Oh, you say, but he'll love me and I'll love him. It will not be enough. It never has been enough. It takes people who fear God to hold on to this covenant and to build this relationship. That's the reason Job stuck with his wife and no doubt blessed her and brought her to be a blessing. And it's the reason this woman was loyal to her husband, and her husband had no doubt in his mind that his wife would be faithful to him, because she was a woman, as the end of this story tells us, who feared God. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. What a wonderful thought that is. She seeks wool and flax, and it continues all the work she did. I'm telling you, she's out with the merchants. She's buying property. And you say, is that the ideal woman? I've got to turn into a real estate agent here. No, that is not what's being said. What's being said is that you give your life for your family. Everything you do is done for the family. That's a great kingdom. You're not being shortchanged because somebody's put you in a home. That is the center of the universe in many ways. Where do you think hearts are built? You want to make money? You want to get in a newspaper? How cheap and tawdry an ideal. How much more the thought of molding and shaping human spirits. Of blessing a man until he achieves what he could never have achieved without you. The end of this story is, verse 28, her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done worthily, but you excel them all. Grace is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she should be praised. Finally, the ideal man is Jesus Christ. He's the ideal for men. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church. Selfless love. The love that's the love of the will, out of the character, out of the heart, that does not depend upon what the other person does at all. The heart that plans and provides, the heart that leads. The heart that leads unselfishly, the heart that says, I'm going to lead so that you will be blessed. I don't care what I have to suffer. I'll yield that if it blesses you. That's what loving your wife and being the head of the wife means. And he is the example for the woman too, because he yielded himself to his father's will. He became the ultimate servant. He became the ultimate and the one who submits to another. And he says in his example to every woman, you can submit and serve and bless powerfully. And so we are called into the image of the Son of God at last, who is the ideal, the hero. We need to aspire to these things. Our hearts are too full of too much rubbish. Our dreams are cheap, small, inconsequential. And we're made for bigger things. Our big problem is that we don't want to dream God's dream. We want to dream our own. I'll read this in conclusion. Written some years ago by a young man named Dale Stone in Minneapolis. When God wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when God wants to mold a man to play for him the noblest part, when he yearns with all his heart to build so great and bold a man that all the world shall be amazed, then watch God's methods, watch his ways, how he ruthlessly perfects whom he royally elects, how he hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him, making shapes and forms which only God himself can understand. Even while his man is crying, lifting up a beseeching hand, Yet God bends but never breaks. When man's good he undertakes. When he uses whom he chooses, and with every purpose fuses man to act and act to man, as it was when he began. When God tries his splendor out, man will know what he's about. You got to get outside this world for your ultimate dream.
You got to think about eternity. And think about what pleases God and what He's prepared for you
to be at last. You've got to get your head in heaven and out of this world. What about you tonight? Are you an ideal man? Do you aspire to be that kind of ideal man of God? Are you an ideal woman? Do you aspire to be God's ideal woman?
Is that your dream? If it's not your dream, it ought to be, and it can be. This is a dream we don't have to give up. This is a dream that will never be taken away from us.
Because, as we said, God planned it that way, and not only that, but divine energy is working to make it possible. And we can choose it, and that's the reason He's told us about it, because He's inviting us to accept it and to achieve it.
I don't care who you are, short or tall, dark or fair, shy or outgoing, you can be the ideal man of God or the ideal woman of God.
And be a blessing in this life to everybody that knows you. And an honor and tribute to God who's made it all possible. Won't you come and accept that tonight by believing in the Son of God and accepting His will in the penitent spirit and being baptized into Him? And won't you, if you've been a Christian who's just sort of been wallowing in indifference, no real dream, haven't thought about it much more than getting to church on Sunday, lift up your eyes and see the vision that God has for you, and make it yours, really. Why was that?